brought to you by the Computer History Museum.
Welcome to From the Archives of the Computer History Museum. I'm curator Chris Garcia. We continue with our 2012 oral history of Evelyn Berezin, conducted by Gardner Hendry. In this episode, she talks about her work as a digital logic designer, as well as the difficulties of being a woman in the male-dominated tech world of New York in the 1960s.
And so I went to the head of the VP in charge of this whole design group, and told him the truth, that I really needed to go. I couldn't do that if I was not in the city somewhere. I didn't know how I could manage anything if I was up in Connecticut, and it took me an hour and a half to get there and an hour and a half to get back.
Right.
So, because you had to get not only the train up there, but you had to get a car somehow to get you to the plant, which was not right in the center of was nowhere near the train, where the train was. He was very nice, and he said to me, I think this is a very characteristic story of the time. He said he'd get a job for me. I didn't have to worry about it. He'd find me a job. And it turned out that he knew the people in the New York stock market. And it turned out that the fellow who was in charge of communications at the stock market, which really was entire engineering department in the stock market, was called communications, was run by this guy who was retiring. And they were looking for somebody, and the guy I worked for knew that and talked to them. And they suggested that the fellow who was leaving come and talk to me, which he did. And he hired me for the job. But this job, it turned out, had to be approved by the board of directors of the New York Stock Exchange.
Okay.
Because I don't even remember anymore.
Vital.
It was a
communications.
It would be a vice president.
Yeah.
A job. And so I came back and told Teller Register that I would be leaving at a certain time. This was now about 1960-61, sometime in there.
Yeah.
That I would be leaving, and he knew about it. I mean, he had set it up, actually, so it was all very companionable. And it turned out we set it up for some months ahead of time when the other guy would be retiring, etc. And then he called me a few weeks later, and he said, I need to talk to you. I went down to the stock market and talked to him. And he said the board said that they could not hire me. And I said, what? Why? I mean, you know, at the time, I was probably one of the two people in the world who could design a machine for them.
Yes.
I mean, I was really just, you know, stunned. And he said, what the board said, and the guy was so sorry to say this. I mean, he was very nice. And he said to me, they said that you were a woman, you'd have to be on the stock market floor from time to time, and the language on the floor was not for a woman's ears. I had worked in laboratories all my life. I had seen practically naked men working on these hot machines. I said, what in the world was he talking about? But there was no way I could get back to them. So that tells you the situation of women at the time.
And so what year is this?
1960. It was before the women's movement.
Yes.
It was before the women's movement. And it was devastating. It was really devastating. I think now, of course, it's easy to say now, because the attitude of the women, of me, my attitude at the time, was, in a sense, just simply paralysis. I didn't know what to do. And I had... And women, it was so a part of me that you didn't object when women were turned away. You used to it. You were so used to it that you didn't try to fight against it. The young people who came after me, who really came after the Black movement and who learned from them, and then when the women really started to object to how they were being treated, that was in the later 60s and 70s, because they had learned from the black, you know, the movement of black people in this country. But at that time, 1960, it was like the old thing. I'm going to give you I think this is important.
Yes.
So I'm going to give you another example. I told you that Marion Keller, who had, in 1975, the highest level job in the country as a woman. I was at GE, was a senior vice president at GE. And I were on the same board. This is much later. And we talked about this experience, and she told me, let me tell you mine. She said when she first got a job at the beginning of the war, because the war was on, at General Electric, she was on she had a degree in physics. And she worked on the drafting board in one of these drafting places that has, you know, 200 people doing drafting in the days before computers.
Yeah.
And there were only a couple of women there, very few women. And they were hiring them, of course, because the war was on. And they knew they would have trouble with getting men there. And this is in the aircraft department of General Electric. She was there about 6 months, and at that point they were reviewed and they would get a little raise. That was the way GE worked. And so that happened. She got a raise of $2 a week, and I think she was making, you know, like 18 or 19. And then she was in the ladies' room, and the other woman was there, and the other woman told her, oh, I got a raise of $3 a week. And Marion was really frightened because she thought she had done something wrong. So she went to the head of the department and she told him that she had heard that this other woman had $3 and she had only gotten $2 a week raise. And she didn't understand, had she done something wrong? She would like to know, because she would like to do the right thing. And he said, oh no, he said, but she's a blonde. That's a true story. That was what it was like. And she didn't say anything.
Okay.
And I didn't say anything.
But both of you remembered it.
Boy, did we. And I have to say now that I think what I really should have done was to ask to see the chairman of the board and to go up to him and say, I have heard all the dirty words that anyone has heard in my lifetime, and it would not bother me for one instant. And furthermore, you are not going to find anybody who can build this machine in this country. And he didn't. He hired people and fired them and hired them and fired them and never got to get a machine that could be done. Much later.
Eventually.
When they were just available machines that you could buy from somebody.
Exactly.
And he lost a lot. So that's that story. I do tell that story to women, because I get the impression that nowadays women don't know what it was like, and I think they should. Okay.
So what happened?
Well, what happened was I talked to the people at Digitronics was the name of a company that had been built on the. From the people who had been fired when they were Ellicom, when Underwood went bankrupt, and there was a new company they were in the same place. A group of them had gotten together and formed a company they called Digitronics, and were building a lot of various kinds of equipment that were all digital, but for instance, paper tape readers.
Famous for their paper tape readers.
Paper tape
because
readers.
Those were the best paper tape readers.
Yeah, did they? I don't know.
Photo tape, paper tape readers.
Yeah.
That, you know, worked on photo sets.
So that was the kind of thing that they were working on. And so they asked me to, they wanted me to come back there, and they offered me a good deal. And with a lot of a sort of easiness about how much time I had to spend coming and going and so on. And so that worked very well. I one of the things that I did there, that's interesting, is there was a job. This was a special purpose. Now, this, I cut back there in about 1960, 61.
Okay.
I just didn't get the job at New York Stock Exchange. Right. And I went back there. And it was probably a few months later that I took a job there. And I really did. I was so depressed about it that I didn't even try to look in other places. I just went back to the people I knew respected me.
Yeah.
And I didn't have, that kind of problem. And I certainly didn't have that problem at Teleregister. I didn't have that problem at Teleregister, even though I walked into a group of 10 men who were doing the designs, and I walked in as their boss. They didn't know me from anything. And we had absolutely no trouble. We were all friends. We worked together, and we worked together with great fun. So that problem had never really existed for me before.
Yes.
So this kind of thing was such a shock that I just didn't know what to do. And I said, I went back to Digitronics. And one of the interesting things I did there during the next year was a racetrack. It turned out that right nearby where the company was on Long Island was Roosevelt Raceway. And they, you know, raceways have these big screens with all the information listed on the screen, but it was run essentially mechanically. People just moved the information up and down, and it got the, it was presented. I mean, they had it wired to a desk, but that's all. It was done manually. And you would be happy to know how they got the odds.
Okay.
There was a guy sitting at a desk, and when the numbers were, the numbers went through these little machines, mechanical machines, and gave the amount, the number of bets on this horse and the number of bets on that horse. And they read the numbers to this guy, and in his head, he did the various divisions and multiplications, and spoke the rate out, and he was always right. Done through the human mind.
A human computer
did those calculations, and then they would just type them in to the board and put him up on the board. And I remember, I didn't know, and I'd never been to a racetrack, actually. And so they took me down to the racetrack to find out how the racetrack worked. And I went through all of the various places. And when I saw that guy staring into space and just, he had earphones on, they were telling him what the numbers were on the machines. And he just simply, on the machines, when they were mechanical, he just spouting out the odds. I was dumbstruck.
How can you do that?
I mean, when you think of it, how could you do it? I mean, these numbers appeared fast, and the days when they didn't have computers, what did they do? It never occurred to me to think of it, but that's what they did. And then they warned me that, I have to say, I was frightened. While I was going through these things, the whole thing was so eerie. The whole way in which this track worked was, and the people who ran it scared me to death. But they were perfectly fine people. I mean, fine. It was just me that had never been to a racetrack before and didn't know how they worked. And they gave me some money and let me bet, and I won. And I don't think they planned it that way. I just did win. Anyway, I designed this racetrack system. They warned me that if that system went down, there'd be a riot. And the system never went down. I mean, I had already learned how to do all this so that it was there was a lot of safety involved in the system. And the thing that was most interesting was that one day, we didn't design or build the lighting system. We just tied into it. But one day, something happened. The power went down and the lighting system went out. And there was a riot. It was true. It was true. There would be a riot if the lights went out.
Yes.
And that's what happened. So that's the racetrack system. And I think that was the first racetrack system that had been built.
Okay.
And they built more of them. I think they built more of them later.
That's fascinating.
Okay. And there were a lot of other small systems at Digitronics. But what happened was I had realized for some time that when you come down to it, from the first day I went to work in the computer industry in 1951 to by this time, towards the end of 1960s, I had the same job. I ran the logic design department. I had never had another job, and I'm looking up the next row up to vice president, and I knew damn well that I would never get that job. That job was for a man, and I would never have that job. And my experience at the stock exchange had taught me that. Mm-hmm. And so what happened then was that I was still a friend of all the people I had worked with all these years. Some of them who had made a lot, who had left the company, started other businesses, done very well. And this is Milt Schwartz particularly. And he said, start your own company. It's the only way to get anywhere. Another friend of mine from NYU, had also started his own company in selling semiconductors. It was a marketing company. He was a physicist also. But it was a marketing company, and he said, get your own company.
For more of Evelyn Berezin's oral history, as well as other holdings, please visit computerhistory.org. From the Archives is produced by Christopher J. Garcia. Music is by John Plute. Thanks for listening to From the Archives of the Computer History Museum.
This program was brought to you by the Computer History Museum.